It's time for the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Podcast.
We've got lots and lots of things to talk about and to do today.
Covering the territories from the 1940s to the 1990s.
It's the best thing going today.
Interviewing wrestlers, referees, authors, and other media personalities that have made the sport of professional wrestling great.
The cream, yeah. The cream of the crop.
And now, here's your host, Tony Richards.
Hey there, everybody. This is Tony Richards, and I want to welcome you to our Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel podcast. On our show, we're tracking and documenting the history of pro wrestling from its beginnings through 1990, with special emphasis on the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s pre-video era. We're profiling personalities by having the authors who've studied their lives and written their stories. We're studying and revisiting territories and the booking offices that control them. Historic towns where the history of pro wrestling is so deep, and the legendary buildings where the fans came to see their favorite stars and storylines play out virtually every single week. We're covering all four of these dimensions of the sport of pro wrestling, and I'm so appreciative you've decided to allocate some of your time to go on this journey with us through this show. If you like what we're doing, you might want to think about visiting my Substack channel by searching for Tony Richards 4, and there you can subscribe to my daily wrestling history newsletter, where you'll find birthdays of wrestlers past and present, an RIP salute daily to those in the business who we want to honor that have passed on, an event on that day in pro wrestling history, and much, much more. You also have an archive of this podcast and special updates on my Dory Funk Sr. book. All of that is provided for free. But I do have a special vault of writings for paid subscribers. And by subscribing to that, that helps support me and my research and the work to do all of this for you. You'll find it all on my Substack channel, substack.com. Search for Tony Richards 4 and the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. You can also follow me on X at Tony Richards 4 or join our Facebook group, Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. Okay, with all that out there, let's go to today's show and today's guest. Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Pro Wrestling History Podcast. And I'm your host and manipulator and booker of the Time Tunnel. And today we're going to go way back in the tunnel. We're going back to the teens and the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. And we're going to look at one of the greatest performers in the history of pro wrestling, Jim Londis. And we're going to use as our guide the book that is out now, that is written by my guest today, Steve Johnson, who is a well-known wrestling historian. He's part of the great team at Slam Wrestling, and he's co-authored a handful of books with Greg Oliver. I've got all of them around here somewhere. If you're a true wrestling historian, you should have these on your bookshelf.
Please feel free to show them off.
Yep, right here. Well, one is missing. It's back on the shelf somewhere, but they're great reference material. And Steve also was a recipient of the James Melby Award back in 2022 at Cauliflower Alley. And he also had the honor, I learned, I probably noticed it at the time, but you got to write the obituary for J. Michael Kenyon. So that was quite a quite an honor. So welcome to the program, Steve.
Thanks for having me on, Tony. I always appreciate the opportunity to talk about these things. They may be distant in time, a century ago, but it's amazing how many lessons are still applicable from Londis's career in the 20s and the 30s to today in 2025, and we can get into that a little bit later.
Sure. Now, Jim Londis is a fascinating character, and probably I find him even more fascinating after I read your book all the way through, and then I went back and read a couple of sections that I just found fascinating, and I had to get my highlighter and my underliner out and everything and mark those so I could go back to them. But from the 20s through the 40s, I mean, he really was the first immigrant to be an athletic superstar in the U.S., right?
Right, and not just in wrestling, in any other sport. And it's amazing to me, looking back, that the wrestling community settled on a 5'8", heavily accented Greek immigrant to carry the business through some of the worst economic times the United States had ever encountered. If you just kind of stand back and take the long view of that, you say, wow, what kind of impact must he have made on the business and on popular culture to be able to take wrestling to new heights, heights that it had never seen before, while the rest of the nation was in a depression? That's probably circumstances, fingers crossed, that we will never undergo again, but it only underscores how important he was, not just to wrestling and not just to sports, but to culture in the United States and culture in other countries as well, Greece, Turkey, South Africa, and all the places he wrestled.
I was fortunate to be born to very young parents who were born to very young parents. So I knew my grandparents when they were in their 40s and 50s and 60s, and they were kids in the Depression. And so it was just interesting as I think back about their habits and their mindset, because the Depression could come back any day. And they really grew up in a time of austerity. And to think that if you had money in the Depression era and you had to make those allocations very carefully about what you were going to do with that, and yet he drew so much money, I think just underscores what you're saying about what a significant draw he was in the business.
As JBL wrote in the foreword, and I was just so glad to have John do the foreword to the book, it's easy to lead the business in times of prosperity. No challenge there. When times are good, when the business is good, it's not much of a challenge to lead the way. When times are bad, economic times are bad, and the business was splintered, and it wasn't just splintered when Landis was around, it was balkanized. To be able to rise above that and take the business to a point where really it was on a plane with boxing, prize fighting, horse racing, and the other sports of the day in the early 1930s. It's amazing to go back as a researcher and take an old copy of the New York Times and see where the New York Times has written an eight column headline on a Landis match. My goodness, I can't conceive of that today. Yet he was headlined in the New York Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer and newspapers all across the country, to the point where, and I cited this in the book, there was a story, I think in the 30 or 31, syndicated with the headline, Wrestling, Oldest of Sports, His biggest money maker in sports today. And that's because of, in large part because of him. So to be able to take that and carry the business to that height is really an amazing thing. He didn't have behind him social media or the internet or even gimmick tables.
Or really much of any kind of media besides newspaper. I mean,
No. And
radio was just coming in the early 20s, and television was still 20 years away.
He did not have a federation,
Right.
a company, well, now it's private, but a once public company behind him, pushing him. So to be able to accomplish all those things and kind of be his own guy at the same time makes him a singularly unique figure in the history of wrestling.
I'm glad you brought that up about the Federation, because I've got a hypothesis I want to run past you a little bit later on. I don't like it when things get overdone, and I'm kind of over the Mount Rushmore thing. But let me ask you something. And of course, he's at the disadvantage of a lot of wrestlers who were pre-videotape era, right? But why do you think Londos never gets mentioned in one of those conversations in where you have the four spots, right?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I do get that sometimes, because if you stand back objectively, he's got to be there. I think there's a couple of
He's
reasons.
almost got to be the first guy.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a couple of reasons. Number one is that he was, and let's say this very quietly so no one hears, he was a wrestler, okay? At Landis's time, wrestling was credible and in the sports pages, and if not necessarily believable, people cared about it. But events that happened kind of in his later career and subsequently relegated wrestling to, at best, the tire ads in the newspaper, and generally no coverage at all. And wrestling became more show, more spectacle than ever. People didn't take it seriously. Fans did, but people didn't take it seriously generally. And so the industry was kind of washed away, and he was washed away with it. I think that's one of the reasons why he's not recognized as broadly as he should be today. The other reason, I think, is kind of a double-edged sword, and that is the internet and the social media and the tendency of people who watch wrestling today to believe that they are part of the greatest thing that has ever happened. This is slightly off topic, but there was a post the other day citing the greatest black wrestlers in history, greatest African American wrestlers in history. And it was basically Booker T and nobody who appeared before 1980.
Right.
We kind of lost that collective memory because that kind of stuff is not available in a readily accessible form on the internet, but what happened in WWE last night or AEW is. So the memories of people have gotten shorter and shorter. Tony, going along with what you do for your day job, the way I phrase it, and I think this is true about wrestling too, is we have more information than ever, but we have less knowledge than ever.
Right.
And so I think those are some of the factors that have affected the standing of Landis and the reason maybe we don't recognize him at this point, a century later, as the innovator that he was.
Well, what's great though, what I will say that's great, and I'm hopeful it does help, is that 20 years ago, we didn't have any of the books that are on my bookshelf behind me about wrestling history. I mean, we've made a lot of progress in documenting and filling in spaces, and your book is filling in a big puzzle piece. I mean, we're coming. I mean, when we get more and more of that documentation, I think we'll have better education. So, I just appreciate your part that you've played in it, and I'm hoping to play a part in it, and it's great. One of the things I found fascinating in the book, when I was growing up, I thought I was pretty daring as a kid. I was doing things in the early 70s as a kid that I thought was pretty free and independent. But man, when you look at Londos at 15 years old, I mean, he's getting on a ship and going to another country. It's pretty bold.
It's amazing if you think back. He was 15 years old when he sailed for 3 weeks across the Atlantic from Greece to New York, really with nothing other than a desire to escape an overbearing father and to settle in a new land. Nowadays, most parents wouldn't let their kids 15 years old go down to the corner without their cell phone or checking on them all the time.
Right.
But it underscored the great sense of adventure that he had, and the sense he had from a very early age that there was something bigger out there. Maybe he didn't exactly know what it was, but he knew that there was something more to be found. So, one of the titles of the book originally that didn't make the final cut was The Journey of Jim Landis, or The Odyssey, to slant to the Greek side of Jim Landis. But it really was a journey or an odyssey for him all throughout his career, encountering mythical beasts like the promoters of the 1920s, and kind of circumnavigating his way around them until he reached his final destination. And he did it on his own. And there's a reference in the book where he says, very bluntly, I did this on my own. My mother and father didn't want me to do this. Anything accomplished was on my own. He wasn't saying it out of spite, but he was saying in a matter-of-fact fashion
Yeah.
that he somehow, as a 15-year-old boy in Greece, coming across the sea as one of hundreds of thousands of Greek immigrants at that time, rose to become the most famous active athlete in the world in the 1930s. To do that, you have to have a level of dedication, forward thinking, persistence that is almost unheard of. And I think those are some of the traits that served him well. And I know in your own work, you talk about dedication, persistence, and forward thinking. He gave new definition to those words.
And so I'm curious about something, and I wondered about this as I was reading the book. And you're obviously the author, so you'll kind of be able to answer this. But it has had a very difficult and complicated relationship with his father, and he definitely was going away from that. But I still sort of sensed that his motivation was that more than running away from something, he was running to something. Like, what's your thoughts about that?
I think that's absolutely true. And I think if you look at, I had to do a lot of research on Greek immigration during that period of time. If you look at the Greek immigration of that period of time, it's probably not quite as remarkable on a singular basis because, in the aggregate, Greece lost about one seventh of its population between 1900 and 1924 to immigration to the United States. There were a lot of people who were trying to escape an unpleasant situation in Greece, whether it was wars or economic decline. And so they see America as a land of prosperity. The Greek shipping company Imbiricos Brothers built special ships to transport mass numbers of Greeks to the United States. So, yeah, he was escaping something, but like a lot of Greeks at the time, he was also running for something or yearning for something that he wasn't going to find at home.
One thing you mentioned early on when we were just starting to talk was the fact that he was a wrestler. And when he started out in the beginning of his career, pro wrestling booking was pretty much in its infancy. And so even though outcomes were predetermined, you still had to wrestle, right? I mean, there was a struggle involved, and often the predetermined outcome may not be what the other guy wants to do,
Oh,
right?
yeah.
And so Londos, he had to be able to wrestle.
One of the things that is almost totally ignored about him is he was an outstanding amateur wrestler. Now, this is 1910, and we didn't have the system for amateur wrestling that we have, obviously, in 2025. But through the records of the tournaments that he wrestled in, you can tell that he was probably the top light heavyweight amateur on the West Coast. He took to wrestling like a duck takes to water. He was athletic, low center of gravity, an intense desire to succeed. All those were key factors in his success, but he was able to take care of himself from a very young age. Then he's doing the amateur wrestling. He's also trying to make a buck here or a buck there in a vaudeville show, doing a balancing act, working with trained monkeys, doing acrobatics, and understanding how to please a crowd at the same time. So then you merge what he's done as an amateur wrestler here and his understanding of how to move mass audiences here and put them together. And it took a while, but he had a very unique fusion of both athleticism and theater for his time. Frankie Kane, who I knew him and we talked about, I've talked about him in the book several times. Just put it this way, he was the first traveling babyface.
One of the parts of the book that kind of caught me by surprise, because in researching the funk book I'm writing, I discovered in your book that there was a relationship with the original Dutch Mantel. And so that my eyes perked up and I leaned in on that. So what about that connection? Tell us a little bit more about that.
I'm going to get in the weeds here because it is so much fun. I originally wrote a piece on the original Dutch Mantel in the Heels book, which is now about 15 years old,
Right.
and it was called Heel with a Heart. And I noticed Londa's traveling out west in California and other areas with someone who generally fit the description of Dutch Mantell, except the names didn't match. And it wasn't until fellow historian Mark Hewitt and I were able to get together and look at a newspaper picture that had Dutch Mantell kind of in the shadow in the background that we realized we were talking about the same guy, that Dutch Mantell was also Smilin' Dutch and Hans Rolf and any other gnomes de plume
And
that.
for those of you who don't know, and you've never seen the original Dutch Mantell, he's got a very interesting facial structure.
He does. He was in Keystone's Cops movies, and he looked like he had taken the bad end of a broomstick all too many times. But he was another immigrant, and kind of like Londo's, a survivor who, found work where he could, wrestled in camps for money, spare change, but was a born hustler, and in Londo's saw somebody he could help advance to the top. So Dutch Mantell was very instrumental in his Landis's career in the early years, and went on, of course, to be so associated with the Funk family, as you're talking about.
Yeah, he
Great
was one of the
character.
fathers of Amarillo wrestling.
Yeah, a great character. I talked to the late Terry Funk about him one time, and if I were to go back now in time, I would have probably pumped him for everything I could, because I think there's at a minimum a long magazine article or maybe even a script sitting there waiting to be written about Dutch Mantell.
I'm going to have quite a bit in my book because there's basically five fathers of Amarillo wrestling, of which Dutch is one of them. And it's just amazing how beloved he was from the public. I mean, he was an entrepreneur. He was very he raised money for all kinds of causes. He was very community oriented. He was not a handsome man, yet he was getting proposals from women all over town who wanted to be his wife. He was just an interesting fellow.
But he is one of the really one of the three discoverers of Landis, and set him along his course. Jack Dodd, Pete Bazukas, and Dutch Mantell are the three guys that you would credit with actually being Landis's trainers and getting him into the business.
It's amazing the roots of people in the wrestling business that go back to him. He broke in Roy Welch. It's just and of course Roy went on to be the father of Southern wrestling here in the United States, but it's just kind of amazing how he has got tentacles going out that we never really had paid attention to before. So Londo, go ahead, sorry.
But at that time, in the teens, in the 20s, the wrestling network was small, and everybody knew everybody. It
Right,
was
right.
very interconnected under the veil, so to speak.
And that tells you what kind of, I mean, if you want to call him a shooter, because he was a wrestler, that tells you the quality, because Dutch Mantell was quite a shooter. So,
Yes, absolutely.
speaking about relationships, long and complicated and interesting relationship with Ed Strangler Lewis.
Yeah, to say the least, Landis and Lewis were oil and water.
Lawler and Dundee.
That I put in the book, Ali and Frazier.
Yep.
You could go in any number of adversarial rivalries over the years, and you'd still be hard pressed to match the intensity with which they disliked each other. It was deep. It was personal. It probably damaged business because they had a 10-year hiatus in matches where they could have probably made some money, but they weren't willing to do it on each other's terms.
Yeah, they wasted probably, it's a little bit like Ali's best years. He didn't box, and so they wasted some really prime years there where they weren't going in matches for the title.
And they were almost exact opposites. Lewis was this big, brawny, sometimes obese, Midwestern fellow. Landis was a smaller, sculpted athlete from Greece who watched his diet very carefully and imbibed in alcohol rarely, if ever. Lewis
It
had no
was the
such
opposite.
problems.
He was
Lewis
the
had no
opposite.
such problems. Lewis was a, kind of a hale and hearty, slappy on the back, never met a friend that he didn't, or everybody he met was a friend.
Mr.
Landis was,
Politician.
yeah, Landis was quiet, reserved, probably on the suspicious side, serious about what he was going to do. It was almost polar opposites. And sometimes opposites attract. Oh, but sometimes opposites repel.
Right.
Yeah. And I think Lewis, looking at Landis, could, popular as Lewis was and successful as Lewis was, could never quite match Landis's popularity or the way Landis was beloved by legions of fans, particularly ethnics and minorities. And I think there was probably some jealousy on Lewis's part.
Yeah, when you have a strong egoed individual, they sometimes have a scarcity mentality instead of an abundant mentality, and that scarcity mentality is fed by what the other guy's got rather than what you have. And Ed kind of strikes me like that. Like, as successful as he was, he still looked at what Londos was doing and was envious of it.
It was, and he didn't consider him a pure wrestler. Of course, here we can digress and say that everybody who's ever wrestled considered the next generation to be lousy and not the way it used to be.
Of course.
And Lewis was not immune to that. And he never drew the kind of money that Landis drew, which may have been the root of all problems. But once you were in a position like Lewis was, with Billy Sandow as his manager and kind of Toots Mont in his corner in the 1920s, and you are in effect running the business.
Yeah,
You're the top dogs in the business.
you're set at that point.
Yeah, you're set and you're kind of unwilling to share the stage with somebody, especially if you don't particularly care for them personally. And I think Landis was the same way. Landis saw Lewis and thought he was hogging the stage, wasn't ready to share the stage.
It reminds
So
me
once.
of Diana Ross's advice to Michael Jackson. Don't ever give up the microphone, Michael. You might not get it back.
Yeah.
And
So it's it's probably a theme that has been passed through wrestling since the start.
sure. I
But
just did.
the rivalry between those two was as pure a rivalry as any in the history of the sport. And of course, it ended up culminating in Chicago in 1934 with the biggest match in the history of the sport to that point and for quite some time after.
So, a couple of other things that kind of pertain to this subject. And I want people to get the book because you need to get the book and read about these things we're talking about because we're not going to be able to give it to you the way the book does. But you just for the information and the pieces about Ed Lewis and Jim Londos alone, you should get this book. But I just did a piece not long ago on John Pisick and the Nebraska Tiger Man. And I was amazed that he only had about 20 losses, but one of those was to Londos. And he was, for a quite some time, Lewis's policeman. And he was someone who did not like working. He wanted wrestling. He wanted to get out there and see who was the best person. So the fact that he would put over Londos, and he only put over 19 guys in his whole career, I thought was pretty interesting given his relationship with Lewis.
It was. Mark Hewitt, one of our fellow historians, talked with the family, his son, years later, and said that John, Tiger Man, had enormous respect for Landis and they got along very well. I suspect that they probably had a similar view of the business in that regard. We're going to advance it as best we can.
Right.
They fought, Landis fought him as early as, 1917 or 1918, I believe, even before he went back to California. So they had a long history together. And whereas Landis didn't like Lewis, didn't care for him, he and the Tiger Man got along. Landis got along with just about everybody else. You did not see him ever say a bad word about anybody, even Lewis.
Now, consequently and inversely, Lou Thesz in his book was not particularly positive about Londos.
Now, most people have kind of chalked that up to the fact that Lou was chummy with Ed Lewis.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
Like, I just
And
kind of came
so,
to that conclusion.
yeah.
I didn't know that, but I was thinking, oh, that must be Lewis's influence on
Yeah,
Lou.
it must be. I don't think there was any. Actually, there is a picture in the book of Lewis and of Landis and Lou Thesz in California at a dinner together. We generally think that Lou was just kind of taking Ed's line there because also if you look at that, Lou was not complimentary of Buddy Rogers either because of things that he had said about Ed Lewis. So saying something about Lewis or having a rivalry with Lewis might have been something of a sore spot with Lou. Although that's not to deny that when we talk about Mount Rushmore, Lou has to certainly be considered for
Of
that
course.
position as well.
I just, I know all humans are biased, and one of the things that affects your bias is your close relationships, right? They can affect your viewpoint positively and negatively. And I'm like, okay, well, he thought Ed Lewis like hung the moon, and so that must be, why he looked down a little bit on Londos. But in the book, and this is something I thought you did really well in the book, you took a very complicated subject, which is the world championship that Londos held. And you did a good job explaining it to people who might get easily, I mean, I get easily confused trying to figure out the lineage of all these things, but I thought you did a good job with that.
The way I've described it, Tony, is if you tried to figure out the world championship puzzle around that time, late 20s, early 30s, yeah, the best way to describe it would be if you took an etch-a-sketch and turned it upside down, tossed it against the wall a couple of times, turned the knobs any which way you could, stomped on it, poured a bottle of Diet Coke on it, and then picked it up, you'd have the answers to how the championship puzzle was solved.
It'd be perfectly diagrammed.
Yes, it was as Byzantine. You think world titles are complicated now?
Oh no.
My
No,
goodness.
every state had a world championship almost back then.
You had state athletic commissions, you had the National Boxing Association, you had the National Wrestling Association, not the alliance, the association. You had in belts invented, if not out of whole cloth, then of partially fabricated fabric. And you had title switches that made absolutely no sense. The best example of that came in 1932. In 1932, the California State Athletic Commission recognized Ed Lewis as world champion. The New York State Athletic Commission recognized Landis as world champion. Landis refused to fight Lewis in New York for a variety of reasons, fearing a double cross, promotional tricks. And so the New York State Athletic Commission pulled its recognition of Landis and, in effect, gave it to Lewis. California found that Lewis was refusing to wrestle Landis in its state. So it did just the opposite. It pulled recognition of Lewis and gave it to Landis. So it's important to the book to organize the title lineage carefully, but I always kind of stick my tongue in the corner of my cheek when I'm talking about the world championships and saying, yeah, the world championships are important, but let's remember Landis was important with or without a belt. In fact,
Well,
he might have even been more important without a belt because when he was not champion or when he was gone for months or years at a time abroad, the business in the US and North America just cratered.
another thought I had, and this is going to sound like I'm veering off, but I'm really not. I'm going to circle back with a thought. I'm just interested in your opinion. But When the National Wrestling Alliance was formed in 1948, probably the biggest driving force for that was to consolidate all these world championships and to have one recognized world champion. And I just wonder, in reading your book and getting to know, I felt like I was getting to know Londos. And when Pinky George is sitting there in Iowa and he's thinking, what would be great is if we had one world champion, and thinking about Pinky George, who booked the state of Iowa, and he doesn't have New York City, he doesn't have Los Angeles, he doesn't have Houston or Dallas, he's got Des Moines, and he's got, you know, all these small towns. I think he may have envisioned what Londos did with his world title run as what he would envision as a model for the NWA title, because Londos didn't just work big towns. He worked small towns too.
And that's one of the amazing stories about Londos and why I think he was so popular, not just with fans generally, but so dominant in sports sections. Okay. Babe Ruth played baseball in New York and Cleveland, but he didn't
Boston
play baseball in Scranton, Pennsylvania,
right,
or Canton, Ohio.
Right.
Red Grange played football in Chicago or New York, but Red Grange did not play football in Davenport, Iowa. Londos wrestled in all those towns.
Right.
And he did on a 365-day-a-year basis. So he's almost constantly in the headlines as world champion. And all the things we talked about with the Etch-a-Sketch and the world championship, when you're a sports writer, you have limited space. You write, Jim Londos, world champion, is coming into town. You know, there's none of these nuances in there. So he's coming into your town, okay? Maybe the only significant athletic event you have in that town, other than maybe a minor league baseball team or something like that, increases his popularity, gets the word out about Londos all over the place. And in the end, yeah, does kind of set the stage for a touring national champion who will wrestle in all corners of the country.
Having your book, reading your book about Londos and the way he toured as a world champion, I'm in 1962 right now in my research, and 61 and 62, and reading newspapers in San Angelo, Texas, or Borger, Texas, and Pat O'Connor's coming to town and he's the world champion. It's an event. I mean, it is a huge, huge deal. And after reading your book, I'm like, well, Londos kind of set the model for that. You know,
he really did set the model for that. He was wrestling 130, 140 times a year. Now, before you get into Ric Flair saying he wrestled 360 times a year, which is true and great.
Sure. Right.
Londos wasn't flying from place to place. He was catching a train when he possibly could. That was his preferred mode of transportation. 130 or 140 times a year was probably the max you could have done before the advent of an interstate highway system,
right,
or cars that would go, you know, more than 50 miles an hour. So that's kind of an amazing thing there. But you're right, it does guarantee a big feature story in every medium and small size newspaper in which he comes in. The world champion is coming to Scranton.
Mm-hmm.
Then you add to that that in a lot of those cities, there were Greek organizations of some kind that would naturally provide a foundation of several hundred tickets and be excited whenever Londos came to town, that would hold a banquet for him or some kind of reception for him. So it became really a community event more so than the way we identify the territorial circuit going from here to there night after night after night.
Right. And for those who are interested in the book, I've read it, but I want to ask you, describe some of Londos' travels outside the States.
Oh, God.
I mean, he traveled the world.
It is fair to say he was the first boxer or wrestler who traveled the world in such a way, and no one would really mimic his travels until Muhammad Ali, which was 40 years later.
Right.
He went to Greece, back to Greece three times in 1928, 1933, and 1936-37. Each time he came back in a stronger position because business in his absence in the US and North America always tailed off a little bit. He wrestled in his world tour in 1936, 1937 in France and England and Greece and Turkey and the former Rhodesia and South Africa and Egypt. I may be forgetting one or two countries along the way, but for a wrestler in that time to have that kind of worldwide appeal, Cyprus, was absolutely unheard of. The chapter on that in the book is called Wrestler to the World, and he really was
Yeah.
wrestler to the world
Fascinating.
with
Fascinating.
all the world travels. And just like when he went into Scranton or Richmond, Virginia, or any place in the United States when he wrestled, when he went to Johannesburg or Cairo or Nicosia, Cyprus, it was an event. It wasn't just a wrestling match. It was an event where this famous athlete, famous cultural figure who represents more than just his sport is coming to our country, is coming to our city. It only enhanced his popularity and put him so much further above any other athlete who was working worldwide at the time that it's really stunning to see the impact that he had.
It's amazing. I had to restrain myself because I knew I was getting to the last 20% of the book, and I knew Londos was involved in some things outside the ring business-wise, so I was kind of excited to get to that. And the reason I knew that is because I had found out in my research on Doc Sarpolis that he had bought the Tucson booking office from Rod Fenton, and Rod Fenton had bought it from Jim Londos and his partner. And so I was excited to get to hear about Tucson and Phoenix and Southern California, and you talked about that in the book. So talk a little bit more about his out activities as he was moving outside the ring toward the end of his career.
In his, when he's about, I think, 42, he appeared before a group in Pennsylvania, large group, and said that he really had three ambitions. One was to regain the world championship, which he did later that year from Bronco Nagurski. The other was to marry and raise a family, and he got married the next year to Arva in 1939 and had three wonderful daughters, two of whom were just, enormous helps in doing this book.
Sure.
And he wanted to transition into promoting a little bit. And so he did. He and John Kontos, his longtime partner in so many territories, acquired Phoenix and the Arizona Territory in the late 40s and ran regularly at Madison Square Garden, the little Madison
The
Square
little
Garden,
one in Phoenix, right? Yeah.
which is a great wrestling venue. He wrestled there occasionally, most famously against G Gorgeous George and the only Londos Gorgeous George match ever, which, if there was ever a clash of cultures in wrestling, that's it. Londos and Gorgeous George.
Absolutely.
But ran that promotion very successfully until I think 1954 when they sold it at a nice profit. By that time, Jim was 60 years old and it was time to pursue other ventures.
So what amazed me about Sarpolis buying it was it's 700 driving miles from Amarillo. And
Yes.
they were running Monday and Tuesday, Monday in Tucson and Tuesday in Phoenix. And I thought, man, who's scheduling that? I mean, they talk about Mid-South being a big driving territory. I mean, that made that huge.
But it was much more convenient for Londos Phoenix.
Yeah,
Because
he just
he was in
ran.
Southern, he was in Southern California most of the
Sure.
time.
Yeah. I mean, Amarillo guys had to go across New Mexico to get there. But it's an outstanding book, Steve. You do great work, but I
Thank
think
you.
this to me is probably one of your best works to date. It's Jim Londos, the Golden Greek of Professional Wrestling, and the subtitle is Studies in Strength and Physical Culture. And John Bradshaw Layfield, our mutual friend, did the foreword and did a fantastic job on it too.
Yeah, the book's worth buying just for JBL's foreword. He went really above and beyond that, but I really wanted him to write it, not because he's just a good guy, but because he understands wrestling history.
He does.
And he really is, in his world championship, a descendant in the line of Jim Londis. Everybody who holds a world championship or has held a world championship is a descendant in the line of Londis. And so it's, I think, important or valuable to go back and recognize what he was doing at the time in the 1920s and 1930s. Not so much making wrestling believable, okay, because there's always going to be believers and non-believers, but making people care. And that's the one thing that has never changed about wrestling. You have to make people care. Doesn't matter if you have a five-star match or a one-star match. If they care, they're going to come back. They're going to get emotionally involved. They're going to talk to people about it. Londis did that better than anybody of his time. And it's really worth studying, I think, going back and seeing how he did that, because that's, again, applicable in 2025, just as it was in 1925.
I'm not sure he didn't do it as well as anybody in any era, because I try to go as far back as I can and make my comparisons going forward rather than forward going backward. And this book just really helped me fill in a lot of clarity on all of that. And I felt like I knew Jim by the time the book was over. So I think that's a compliment to you.
Well, thanks. And it could not have been possible without Vicky Mutzari, my translator and researcher in Athens,
The amount of
because
Greek newspapers that you guys translated is
I
crazy.
know it was she did such an amazing job, Tony. Yeah, I could have written this book just was on the basis of what was in the English language press. It would not have told you a quarter of the story of who Landis was and what motivated him. So, she's in the thank you. Her title's not on the cover. Vicky isn't, but it very well could be, because she helped navigate an area that I don't think has ever been looked at before.
Well, none of us do any of this work alone. I mean, we are standing on the shoulders of the people that came before us and laid down information, and all the people we gather in the kind of a pseudo team to help us put these things together. And it sounds like you did a great job of putting together a great team to help you with this.
Yeah, it is a team effort. Yes.
You bet. So where can people follow you and keep up with you so they'll know what you got coming next?
Sure. Well, the easiest thing for this book is just londosbook.com. There is the information on where you can buy it. I have a few stories in there that didn't make it into the book because we couldn't publish the book so thickly that it would be available only to an independently rich bibliophile. The LondisBook.com is where you can pick up that. On Twitter or X, it's Steel Belt Steve. I don't post there very often, but occasionally there's some stuff up there that I find that might be of interest.
You sneak in there every now and then when
I
something
sneak in every
catches
now
your
and
eye.
then when I have something worthwhile to say, which unfortunately exempts 98% of the Twitter or X community.
And sometimes it's to help keep me on track, because
That's right.
I'll put something out there every now and then, and Steve and my peers will let me know that I missed the boat, so I got to go back and change it, which is a good thing about what we do and the guys we have.
And then we have the other books are available on Amazon, and Greg Oliver and I are working on some other projects right now
Yeah, good.
that are start and go. They're starting good, they're going good. There may be a speed bump here or two, but we expect to have some pretty good stuff coming out in the next few months. And I have a book that should be available probably by summer, but we'll get into that next time.
Okay, good. Well, this is Jim Londos. It's published, by the way, by McFarland Press, and written by Steven Johnson. And Steve, thank you so much for coming today. And I love your book, and I hope you'll come back and talk about some of your future stuff.
Well, thanks for having me on, Tony. I really appreciate it.
All right, Steven Johnson, everybody. Well, I hope you enjoyed sitting in on our visit today, taking a trip back in the pro wrestling time tunnel. Hey, visit my Substack channel at TonyRichards4. Subscribing to my newsletter helps support the work I do to preserve pro wrestling history. Plus, you get it in your email inbox every single morning, and you never miss an issue of the newsletter or a podcast if you have a free subscription. If you have a paid subscription, that supports my work even more, and you'll get special stuff in the vault. Updates on my Dory Funk Sr. book, which is coming along really, really nicely. I'm close to the end of the research phase and about to start the writing phase later on this fall. I appreciate your investment of time in our show today, and I hope you like and subscribe our podcast and our newsletter. And until next time, bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Podcast. Tune in for another great episode next week, interviewing wrestlers, referees, and media personalities that have made the sport of professional wrestling great. Be sure to follow us on Facebook at Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. We'll release a new episode soon. Don't you dare miss it.